Hey, it's Stoner. This week on the show, I talked to Alexandra Chasen, who's a professor here in New York City. She has a new book about Harry Anslinger, who was America's first drug czar and was the person who coined the term marijuana and in many ways branded the Reefer Madness period of America, which was the first chapter in drug prohibition. Later to be doubled down upon with the more modern war on drugs. He's a fascinating person. It's a fascinating book and is really unlike any historical nonfiction that I've ever read. I'm Aaron Lammer. I'm the host of the show. Every Tuesday, I talk to someone about weed. If you're enjoying the show, first of all, tell a friend, but maybe also rate us in iTunes or leave a comment. We appreciate it. You can always send an email, hi@stoner.co. Welcome, Alexandra Chasen.
Thank you.
First of all, you're a professor. Where are you a professor?
I'm associate professor of literary studies at Eugene Lang College, which is the undergraduate liberal arts division of the New School in New York.
And I very much understand how someone with that background would have written this book. So the book's Assassin of Youth, a kaleidoscopic history of Harry J. Anslinger's war on drugs. So when you meet someone on an airplane, how do you describe this book to them?
I describe this book as part biography,
yes,
of Harry J. Anslinger, part cultural history, and part lyrical meditation. The book kind of tries to cover a lot of ground looking at the different sources of the drug war, some of which are broadly cultural and some of which are channeled through this one personage, Harry J. Anslinger, who was the first commissioner of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, so our first drug czar.
This is like, if there's like second wave ska and first wave ska, this is the first wave drug war, which, as someone who knew almost nothing about it before I read this book, has many echoes of the second wave. Many of the themes repeat themselves. Harry J. Anslinger as the first drug czar, like, how did you first come across him and what interested you in him as a historical figure?
Yeah, well, I worked backwards from a contemporary observation of the state of our prisons and the disproportionate presence of young Latino and African American men in prisons doing time for minor nonviolent drug offenses. And my question was, how did we get to that situation? One of the big causes, one of the leading causes of that racial skew is the war on drugs. And the war on drugs does go back before Nixon and Rockefeller drug laws, back before the 1950s and the passage of the Boggs Act and related legislation, back even before the 1930s, where Harry J. Anslinger was pushing through federal legislation against marijuana, and back at least as far as I would say to the passage of something called the Harrison Act in 1914, went into effect in 1915.
Yeah, the Harrison Act is like, if this was a movie, the newspaper would fly across, Harrison Act passed. So in a nutshell, what was the Harrison Act? Why is it important?
Yeah, it was an innocent little act at the time. It was designed to require physicians to register and to pay a very small licensing fee for the ability to write narcotics prescriptions to patients. And then immediately, and for about 12 years following the act's passage, it was used to prosecute physicians in huge numbers. I've heard arguments that there were tens of thousands of physicians across the country who were prosecuted, and they were prosecuted for two kinds of cases. One was cases where they were prescribing large quantities of narcotics to fictitious patients working in cahoots with pharmacists all around town and receiving money for having done so. In those cases, doctors were clearly dealing drugs, and that was
the old-timey pill mill.
Exactly. That was a sort of emergence of a kind of a dealer figure where good drugs go bad. But there was another kind of case that was also very common, and that was where the doctor was prescribing maintenance prescriptions. In other words, just giving a patient enough narcotics to stave off the withdrawals that the patient would go through otherwise. So on the one hand, you have the doctor and dealer that are mediating figures, and they're very important because they mediate between two imagined poles. One is the originator of bad drugs, often of color, very often coming across a national boundary into the United States. And on the other side, a figure of imagined intact white American purity. And so you very often get the figure of a white woman. And this is a very old trope. This goes back to the days of slavery, where what's at risk is pictured as a white woman. And she kind of stands for an imagined intact American past pre-contamination by racial and foreign others.
One thing that was surprising to me is like the marijuana-related posters and scare tactics have had such an enduring history as a design novelty that I'm very familiar with them. But at the time that Harry Anslinger becomes the drug czar, marijuana is not a popular drug in America by any stretch.
Yeah, no. Marijuana was very little known. And so he had to do two things simultaneously. He had to produce a social problem in order that a solution was called for. And then he, of course, produced the solution. And by 1937, he had pushed through federal legislation criminalizing marijuana. But of course, as you say, he did that in very short order, even to head first to publicize marijuana as a thing. It grew wild. People didn't use it much. And so he was noted for being a very effective propagandist. He took advantage of the space that he had to name and describe and define marijuana as a social problem. So even to call it marijuana, which has, as a Spanish word, associations that he very much wanted to foster between marijuana and Mexicans. Again, the idea being that the threat comes across the border.
And marijuana is basically just the Spanish term. I mean, he just, you know, took a back of the envelope.
It's the Spanish word for Mary Jane. It's actually just backwards. It doesn't originate in Latin America. It's a Spanishization of an English word.
Oh, so it's like double Google translated.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So what was the purpose of all, like, why create a drug in order to eradicate it?
I think that Anslinger was a real dyed-in-the-wool law and order guy, and I think that he really thought that drugs were bad, and I think that he really believed that marijuana caused violent and criminal insanity. He was completely closed to any evidence to the contrary. He refused and rejected a lot of scientific evidence, and I shouldn't say a lot. There wasn't very much.
Yeah.
But I think he really believed that it was dangerous.
But, I mean, I guess this is a little like an ISIS beheadings kind of situation, which is in proving that it was dangerous, he also notified millions of people that existed.
Well, absolutely. And one of the ironies of his career is that he kind of spoke out both sides of his mouth, as he would routinely decry sensationalist coverage of drugs, lest it stir up interest among young people. At the same time, his description of drugs is lurid. His description of events involving drugs is lurid. And it could be said that, in a way, he was the greatest producer of sensationalist literature about marijuana and other narcotics.
Well, you kind of describe in the book these parallel titillated industries of law enforcement and Hollywood gossip, basically tabloid media. The law enforcement is creating the fear and the paranoia, and then the tabloid media is pairing it with marketable young stars and creating real life narratives around it. I totally get where like the tabloids are coming from on that, but I continue to wonder, like, particularly someone like Anslinger, who you describe as a bureaucrat, tried and true. What's the strategy behind turning it into a movie, I guess?
Yeah. So I think there's a lot going on. And I think what he finds is an opportunity to conflate. And frankly, I'm not sure how much of this is fully conscious in his mind. I don't think he was a very reflective thinker. And I think that he kind of arrived at effective practice, but that's not the same thing as really deeply considered strategy. So I do think he kind of stumbled into this conflation, and he had his own prejudices. He was very racist, and he had a longstanding set of prejudices of or fear against even white ethnic others that as early as his teenage years in Altoona, he cites a kind of animosity, a standing animosity that he had against Sicilians working on the railroad in his hometown. So I think that he finds a very useful vehicle for collapsing drugs and what he imagines to be the agents of social problems. And so I think that, again, he really believes that control of inner cities depends on control of multicultural situations. There was a lot of social science in the 1920s and 30s suggesting that the problem with inner cities is that they are multicultural, multilingual, that people, immigrants coming from numbers of different places are all mixed there, and that that creates a pathological social situation. Again, I think he believes that.
Like, you describe him as a true believer. Certainly, like, there's a growing consciousness across the 30s and 40s where it's like, well, at least I've heard of marijuana. I might not have ever seen it, but, like, I've seen a scare movie about it. There's certainly some masterful narrative in that I think, at least, if not Anslinger himself, he created, like, basically a movie genre of the, like, white woman raped at the side motel, tied to a bed. So, I mean, like, some of you know what we think of as, like, modern day horror comes out of that. Had any of these people, like, actually, like, were people like Anslinger exposed to anyone who'd actually tried marijuana?
No.
Because I'm also wondering, at this point in time, the 1930s, I mean, so they've done, like, potency tests on marijuana from the, like, late 60s and early 70s that show, like, maybe a 10% of the current THC. And this is even more side ditch, like, absolutely no cultivation. I mean, was this stuff, like, actually getting people high at the time?
Well, there was a study called the LaGuardia Commission that was commissioned by Mayor LaGuardia in 1937. And they tested people in New York City for smoking and concluded that marijuana did not make people criminally insane, that it made them laugh a little bit and then go to sleep.
Yeah.
And so that's familiar, you know, as an empirical description of what happens.
There's a Walter Benjamin essay where he describes smoking hash and I think walking through a market somewhere in Southern Europe. And he's like, it was incredible. Like, I thought 10 hours had elapsed, but it had only been 15 minutes. I was like, oh.
Potent
okay,
enough.
Okay, I think that's the same substance. So,
absolutely.
There is some common thread. But, like, when you were going back and investigating this book, were you also reading sort of contemporary accounts of using marijuana? Like, when did it get to be the point where you could read about someone who had actually done marijuana?
That's a great question. I don't know of any before the 1950s.
Yeah.
And the first drugs that I know that law enforcement kind of play with that way is more around the attempts at truth serum and dosing that the proto CIA.
Yeah, the kind of MK Ultra
stuff. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I remember I read a book about that, and I think they had given it as like a challenge to a bunch of college professors and said, like, you know, basically unlimited resources, try and make a truth serum. And this one professor was like, I've got it, but I'm not going to tell you what it is. We're going to test it in a blind clinical sense. They said, great. And they tried it, and it didn't really work. And they were like, you got all these guys out here. We're like, what's the deal? And he's like, oh, it worked, like, incredibly on these college students. They're like, what is it? They're like, it's a combination of alcohol and marijuana. And he had, like, gotten kids to say anything on it.
Right, they spilled their guts.
So we don't really know that much about, like, actual drug use. We know more about, like, drug enforcement during this period than we know about drug use. Because I think a lot of people who read this book or might be interested in this book, it's because they're interested in modern day drug prohibition, which is something we experience in America right now. How did the average person experience the drug czar's war?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good question, and one that's hard to answer authoritatively. Anslinger didn't have the kind of profile that Hoover had, who was sort of an analogous figure running a government agency into law and order. And like Anslinger, very excited about covert operations and undercover work. But Anslinger did not have that kind of persona. He didn't have that kind of name recognition. And so it is hard to know whether people even knew they were experiencing a drug war. It also took decades for the kind of numbers to ramp up to what we've been seeing. And I don't think you can really talk about the mass incarceration effect before the 1980s. Obviously, in the 70s, there's a, you know, a rhetorical ramp up and a real ramp up. But even though some of the legal cornerstones are in place, I would not say that you have the same scale of policing activity around drugs, certainly in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and even 60s, that you do after that. So it's hard to know what people made of it, whether most people had any awareness of it at all. I know, and this is what the where I've drawn the title of the book from, the name of an article that Harry Anslinger co-authored in 1937 called Assassin of Youth. By Assassin of Youth, he meant marijuana. And that article was published in a nationally distributed magazine, sort of like Life magazine before its time. So lots of people would have read that. And it opens with what we were just talking about before, an apocryphal scene of a white woman splattered on the ground outside of a an apartment building in Chicago. She has gone out the window of a marijuana party somewhere above. I say apocryphal because I couldn't find any evidence that she ever existed. I can't prove that she didn't exist, but she so perfectly reproduces that trope that it had to be her.
Okay, so that idea, the marijuana, I want to talk about marijuana parties.
Yeah.
Because this narrative that Anslinger is spinning is basically the roots of counterculture. Like what he's describing is defining, you know, these secret parties, the secret sort of lingo of handshakes and dealers. In some ways, he does create a reality out of fiction. It's not a literal reality. But I'm wondering, like, as he starts to create this world of this assassin of youth, people flying out of windows at crazy party worlds, what real parties started happening? Like, how did this start informing the real world? And, I mean, I think that I guess, pick up the narrative thread often with, like, New York jazz in the 30s, like these small subcultures that started to become associated with marijuana.
Yeah, well, and certainly this was a huge boogie for Anslinger. He was a little bit obsessed. He was obsessed with Billie Holiday, for example, and he did believe that there was a lot of partying going on in jazz clubs and among African-American jazz musicians especially. This was really one of his bugaboos. And there's no doubt in my mind that he lent some cachet to it by doing that. He was the picture of a square. So he absolutely participates in a number of different ways in creating a very active subculture.
Well, and the whole idea of the square doesn't really exist until there's a not square out there. I mean, when I think of like the history of partying, basically, like this book is kind of like, this book is about the birth of modern partying.
Yeah.
Because you situate how drugs first came to America with Chinese railroad workers, basically people whose labor was so onerous that it was only conceivable under the influence of narcotics.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very different idea of doing drugs than we came to know in the 20th century America. We sort of reframe the idea of doing drugs as something you do in your leisure time. Is that something, is that a natural evolution? Like what's happening in Europe at the same time?
As far as the birth of modern partying goes, in a way what Anslinger has a hand in is a kind of racial and class compartmentalization of partying. Drug taking has always existed and it's had different functions in different cultures. So I think that the increasing criminalization of drugs over the course of the 20th century is, in a sense, the unique addition to the face of partying. That is, that it's illegal. has a lot to do with styles and kinds of partying, certainly in the United States in the 20th century.
We've got some other we got changes to the work week coming in and the whole idea of, like, do you have to just work all the time as long as you're alive?
Right. I mean, you can't have a recreational drug if you don't have recreation.
Exactly. Like, I in some ways I understand why, like, booze is the vice of the 20th century because it, like, you can see it sort of riding the course of how people, like, live and work. This is, like, a stretch. I'm stretching here. But if you look at right now as sort of the time when there's a weed revolution happening in America, there's also parallel, revolutions happening in labor where people are, like, not going to offices as much. Employment is not as stable. People are freelancers. It does seem like these things do, like, walk alongside how people work and live.
Okay. And to counter that lovely utopian vision, I would say the present moment is also characterized by a pervasiveness of pharmaceutical drugs that could make it look as though the function of narcotics is to adjust people to soul-sucking labor that's not going to cover the costs of life.
Yeah.
Anyway, so it's hard to say.
Yeah. So where does this leave you on? Like, what did researching the first wave of drug prohibition make you think about the current wave of drug prohibition?
It made me very sad to see some of the same tropes in play over the course of more than 100 years, particularly very racist equations and racist accounts of social issues. It makes me incredibly sad to see criminal justice frameworks block public health frameworks over decades and decades and decades. I am a little bit encouraged to think that marijuana is in the process of being reclassified as something more like alcohol, which to me does reflect its actual levels of individual and collective risk. In other words, I think it's less risky than alcohol, so I think it should be classified as something more like alcohol. On the other hand, that doesn't do very much to chip away at our monolith of drug prohibition and the kinds of law and policy and ideology, really social mythology, that govern other narcotics. As far as that goes, I think we could take a page from the experience of other countries where there are models of small and few, but models of relative legalization that make it look as though crime does not go up and addiction rates do not go up, and that is possible to destigmatize to some extent. The other thing is, I don't know if you are familiar with Jay-Z's op-ed that he put in the New York Times, his four-minute video.
I saw it.
In which he raised, I think, a very interesting point about the economics of a legal marijuana market. If felons are prohibited from opening dispensaries, then they are ruled out of a market. Who's going to profit from a legal market in cannabis is going to be rich white men, is going to be the people with the capital who already have the capital.
It feels to me like a choice between prohibition and big scale business. And I don't really know, like, who else can win. But for me, in terms of my interest of this show, I think that there's tons of interesting things in unpacking the legal, criminal justice, social justice elements. And there's some not that interesting things to unpack in, like, business and people who are, like, looking for a fast company write up of their startup. And then there's this third pool that isn't really, the stakes are very different, which is culture.
Yeah.
And to me, that's always been the most fascinating. The thing that's fascinating about weed is not, like, a plant that gets you high. It's that it, like, creates culture and it embeds itself within culture. And to me, what's the most interesting about legalization would be the cultural shift in America. If America were to, say, shift away from booze, we don't think about how everything we do at night is about selling beer, basically. You go to a concert, you go to a sports event. These are places that are designed to sell beer. what happens to America?
Yeah, well, I have to say I have the perspective of a pervert on this one, and I mean this nearly literally. I say, having issued the caveats that I did before, of course, I'm absolutely in favor of legalization. And of course, if it's going to be legal, it's going to be a market. As you're saying, here we are in advanced capitalism. There is no other way. But on a cultural level, I think that there's going to be a huge cost. I came out as queer at a time when that meant having names called and things thrown. It had, again, some of that cachet, some of that outsider status, and it was thrilling. And there was a point in the late 90s where I kind of began to feel it was about the marriage and the military, and I began to feel like the thrill is gone.
Yeah.
I feel a little bit like that about marijuana. Like, you know, it's going to be safer. That's great. There's all kinds of great things that are going to follow from legalization. But from my perspective, a little bit, the thrill is gone.
You lose a little something. Yeah. All right, well, let's talk about, because I think queerness is an interesting foil for stonerness. I ask a lot of people to come on the show, some of whom I don't know if they smoke marijuana, don't smoke marijuana, some of whom I do know, but maybe the world at large doesn't know. And I've been struck what a nerve it strikes to be out or not out about marijuana. And you'd be surprised, people who shouldn't be shocking that they use marijuana. I don't really want to talk about it on air. You know, do you see a parallel between those politics and what does your experience with queer politics say to you about how America will come out as marijuana users?
Yeah, I do see an analog. I can speak to this on a personal level. I'm not sure that I stand for the rest of people, because even with respect to a larger queer community,
sure,
I feel like really all they wanted was the barbecue. So I don't think the thrill is gone for everybody. I think you have to be a special kind of pervert to feel that it's only thrilling if it's taboo. So I also don't want to talk about my personal drug use publicly, but I do feel obligated to do it, and in some of the same ways that I felt obligated to come out earlier in history, and that is to stand up in an attempt to destigmatize the taking of drugs. Professor Carl Hart, who's a psychologist who teaches at Columbia University, argues that it's especially incumbent upon white women to come out about their personal drug use, because they are not at risk for the same kinds of costs as people of color who do so. So it is extremely unlikely I'm not going to be at risk of losing my children.
Right. Or
my job. And so I do feel like I will take up that call if that does forward the cause of destigmatization.
Why would you not be comfortable, like, outside of being an activist in a way in there, what would make you uncomfortable about that knowledge being public?
Stigma persists.
Yeah. We talked about how Anslinger invented this idea of the marijuana party, the out-of-control marijuana, many of the taboos that we're worried about coming out. Does that mean in some way we're like living in Harry Anslinger's dream of like what marijuana is like? Is our whole concept of marijuana in some ways like the inverted flip side of his? Because I'm like, when I think about the taboos, people will cite like Cheech and Chong kind of stuff, and I'm like, Cheech and Chong are like fictional characters. Like, do people don't really think that people who use marijuana are like Cheech and Chong characters? I guess I'm wondering like where the negative stereotypes come from and how you unbrand from something that is itself a scare.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And of course, there will be caricatures that may make it look like there's more misinformation circulating than there is. There's plenty of caricatures of people who are drunk.
Yeah.
In popular culture, you'll see exaggerated representations.
Yeah.
I think that we are living in a kind of mirror in a party that is, in Anslinger's worst imagination, in a certain way. On the one hand, as I just said, I think some of the juice of that party is siphoning off as this becomes old news and big business. But I also think that There's a way in which Anslinger is still having the last laugh. We still are the reason that there's any juice left, the reason that there's any sensation of counterculture left, is that we are still living in a culture, and maybe even more than in Anslinger's time, where repressive policing is ubiquitous. I think that even though it looks as though disinhibition has flourished, that the understructure, the substrate of prohibition is still so rock solid that we are, in a sense, still living in the nightmare image in Harry J. Anslinger's mind because we are not yet free.
Interesting. Do you use marijuana yourself?
I do.
Have you, you've been using it since your younger days, since your, when being radical was still fun days?
Intermittently.
Intermittently.
I would say, yes.
What's the experience like for you now? You're a professor, you've got kids.
Yeah, it's, I keep the stuff in a locked box to protect the children.
Gun safe.
Exactly. Pretty tame.
Yeah.
Pretty tame.
Is it still part of your social world?
No, not really.
At what point did you shift from being like a social to a like non-social marijuana person?
I guess maybe in my 30s.
Yeah. When was the first time you smoked marijuana?
I think that I was probably around 14.
I feel like whenever we give, like, everyone's like, they should wait till they're 22. Well, I was 11.
I'm telling you, it makes you so stupid so fast.
What were you up to when you were 14?
I was in New York City.
Oh, yeah. You're a city kid.
Kid looking for trouble.
What part of the city are you from?
Manhattan.
Oh, wow. What was like 14-year-old teenage like weed culture in the city like?
In those days, you went to the Band Shell in Central Park.
Yeah.
Or at least some of my friends did. I actually never went there, but I know that a lot of my friends went to the Band Shell in Central Park, Lower East Side. It was again for young white people. It didn't seem like a big problem to smoke a joint on the street at that time.
Yeah.
But that for sure was not a universal experience among people smoking dope in Manhattan.
Did they have delivery weed in your youth?
If they did, I didn't know about it.
How did you get like weed in the teenage city days?
Wow, and now I'm trying to remember. It was in a baggie.
Yeah.
It cost $5. It was a nickel bag.
Okay, nickel bag, $5.
I haven't thought about that in a long time.
Well, thank you very much, Alexandra Chasen. Assassin of Youth is out now.
It is.
Where can people who like want, do you have like a website or anything, a Twitter to send people to?
AlexandraChasen.us, a website with plenty of professional information, news about the book. Also, the University of Chicago Press website has information about the book.
We will be back next week. And that was Stoner. We're here every Tuesday. Send us an email, hi@stoner.co. Or if you'd like to ask a question for our mailbag that will come out someday when enough people call. Hey, you've been calling. A few people have been calling. Thank you. 347-464-1625. Thanks to everyone who's been telling their friends. We got all kinds of new listeners, and this show is very exciting to me right now. Please stay tuned.